I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Hi, this is Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. And as you've probably noticed, A Taste of the Past has been on summer hiatus these past several weeks. But I'm happy to announce that you can expect new episodes to begin streaming next week. In the meantime, I would like to introduce you to a brand new series here on Heritage Radio Network that's right up my alley, so I thought you might be interested as well. It's called Eat Your Heartland Out, hosted by Capri Cafaro, a Midwesterner cookbook author who sets out to answer that elusive question, what is American Midwestern cooking? She talks about the formation of various cuisines through the immigrants who settled in different areas, their cultures, people, along with the abundance of local ingredients, all of which helped, over many years, to form the foodways of the region. In her series, Capri Cafaro talks about the intersection of communities and food, and, in her words, aims to weave a tapestry of cultural diversity, immigration history, migration patterns, and agricultural variations in each episode. Expect to gain new insights about Midwestern foodways through compelling interviews with historians, authors, chefs, and makers, each of whom brings a unique perspective on the Midwest's culinary story. We're streaming the very first episode for you right here, and I hope you enjoy it. I know I'm looking forward to many more episodes and informative shows from Eat Your Heartland Out.
Welcome to Eat Your Heartland Out, a brand new series about the food and culture of the American Midwest. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and I want to take just a minute to introduce myself, as I will be your tour guide through this audio exploration of the Heartland. I am a Midwestern native from the state of Ohio, once known, as you may know, as the heart of it all. That was our slogan back in the day. My corner of the Midwest is not rural, but rather industrial. It's an area filled with Italian restaurants, Slavic festivals, and annual Oktoberfests, symbols that represent the immigrants who settled there at the turn of the 20th century. I decided to create this show to share the untold story of my region. Yes, the Midwest is a geographic designation made up of 12 states from the plains in the west to Ohio in the east. But it is so much more than places on a map. Some call the Midwest flyover country, a term often used to describe the area between New York and Los Angeles. And frankly, a term many of us Midwesterners see as insulting, as it insinuates the Midwest is without a character of its own. Some refer to the Midwest as the breadbasket of America, describing agricultural states that are well known for producing food for the nation and the world. In this series, we will explore the cultures that make up the fabric of the American Midwest, immigration and migration patterns that shape the region's identity, agricultural practices and resources that have influenced the development of Midwestern food. How have these factors influenced the often overlooked rich culinary diversity of America's heartland? Well, we're about to find out. Join me as we take a journey together into the tastes of the American Midwest, here on Eat Your Heartland Out on Heritage Radio Network. In part one of our introduction, we will be setting the stage, introducing the people, places, and products of the American Midwest. How does this unique tapestry inform the region's foodways? That is exactly what we will start to discuss today in our lineup of informative and knowledgeable guests. Joining us first is Mark Anthony Arsenio from the Department of Anthropology at The Ohio State University. He has an expertise in the anthropology of food.
It's great to be here.
Well, as someone who has an expertise in this area, the anthropology of food, I thought that you would be a great person to kick off our series to provide us with a backdrop and context about how we want to think about the intersection of communities and food. What's a good framework that you would use as an anthropologist when thinking about how food and communities intersect?
So for me, food is biology, its symbol, and its culture, right? And so we have these three different aspects to food, and it's the way that we study how humans relate to food, what it means to them, how are all these things interconnected with one another. So the first of these is biology. It's we all need to eat, and our nutrition needs to typically be considered. We need it to survive, and there are different ways that health officials interpret this and how that's played out in practice at the community level. And at the same time, it's also a cultural thing. It's something that's shared and passed down. We're talking about generations to generations. When we look at transitions to agriculture, to industrialization, to the mechanization of food, we're looking at the way that the different ways that food ends up changing and how it permeates our cultures and subcultures. And in this process, food becomes a sort of symbol. And so for the individual or for the group, food means something. And it's looking at how all of these different pieces, food that we're buying from the supermarket for nutritional reasons, or perhaps for cultural reasons, or because it's something it's something that means something to me. These are different ways that we can look at it on a more holistic kind of
level. Very, very interesting. And as you're mentioning these factors in this framework, biology, culture, symbolism, I'd like to hear a little bit more about how this could be applied to looking at the interpretation of Midwestern foodways. How do these three factors come together to help explain or interpret Midwestern foodways with different immigrant communities coming into the area, different agricultural resources and terrain throughout a very diverse geographic region, and ultimately how that all comes together to make Midwestern foodways?
Yeah, it's a large question for a very large region, like you're saying, that is so diverse and full of different ecologies and perspectives. So I think one of the sources that I'd like to start with, if I can, is the American Midwest, an interpretive encyclopedia. And it was edited.
It's a great text, and one that I would suggest anybody pick up if you want to learn about the Midwest, for sure.
Yeah, it was edited in 2006 by Dr. Richard Sisson and the late doctors Christian Zacher and Andrew Caden, all from OSU, from Ohio State. And the way that they're considering even recent migratory waves, it may be a little outdated since it was 2006, but I think this is a good place to start. And the way that they talk about food and foodways for the Midwest especially is looking at the very specific physical environment, right? This diversity of space, as well as the complicated immigrant history that we've got in this area. And so we take a look at these two things holistically in this anthropological approach to food. And so when we look at the different environment and where we are, where we're situated, we'll have different wild fruits, different berries and things that are grown in very specific locations. We also have the influence of corn in agriculture. And because of that, it's not much of a surprise that we now see, corn dogs in Illinois, corn flakes coming from Kellogg, Michigan. There's even a thing called corn cob jelly in Indiana.
Have these different,
right? I haven't been fortunate to taste that yet. But you have these different foods that are very endemic and very local, situated in place, and you have these traditions that start to be centered around those things. And in addition to the land-based products, we also have the influence of the Great Lakes and how water is obviously home to seafood and fish, and the importance of the population and populations that are coming in and trying to reap these natural resources. And another place to also take a look at is the importance of pork and other animals being fed on corn feed, and what all of these different things, how they come to define the region from these very, what seem like very disparate kind of ingredients, but things that, again, are very local and situated in place. Also point out that as we're talking about immigration into this area, we can't ignore the entanglements with indigenous identities and perspectives.
Absolutely.
And the ways in which, you know, we have this story that I would hope that most of the listeners know of indigenous communities being pushed out of their original homelands. But at the same time, there's that initial contact before all of that where community leaders are showing immigrants, you know, how to cultivate corn, how to tap maple syrup, how to grow rice, how to hunt for morels. And so you have all these different ways in which cultural sharing is happening in place. And then, you know, we speed up a little bit, and over time we have Europeans coming in, namely from Italy and from Europe throughout the first 100 years. And then more recently, in the next century, we see people coming from different areas of the world. And so all of these perspectives are being drawn in, not necessarily, I mean, complicating Midwestern cuisine and heritage, but also incorporating that into the lives where people are also coming from.
That's a great introduction, Mark Anthony, to provide our listeners with a jumping off point as we go on this journey further into Midwestern culture, Midwestern cuisine, Midwestern identity, and a great lead into our next guest as well. So, Mark Anthony, thank you so very much for joining us again. Mark Anthony Arsenio from the Department of Anthropology at Ohio State University. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So our next guest is Cynthia Clampett, a food historian with two books that focus on the Midwest. Midwest Maize, How Corn Shaped the U.S. Heartland, and Pigs, Pork, and Heartland Hogs, From Wild Boar to Bacon Fest. She is also working on a new book from the University of Illinois Press, tentatively titled Visiting Midwest History, which will cover all aspects of Midwestern history, including culture and food, from Native Americans up into the beginning of the 20th century. Cynthia, it's so great to have you.
Thank you, Capri. It's great to be here.
Well, we have so much to talk about. I know how passionate you are and knowledgeable you are about the subject, which is why I wanted to talk to you in our inaugural episode. And so I hope that you can share with our listeners a little bit about the context of the Midwest. What kind of cultural groups are present in the Midwestern part of the United States, and how did they get there?
Well, that is a huge story.
Yes, it is.
It was a lot of people came. In fact, the Midwest was settled faster than any other region in the history of the world, and they came from everywhere. But the first waves, right after the American Revolution, the first waves would have been from the eastern formerly colonies. And you can kind of see that as you go through. Get fish boil up in Wisconsin because they came across from New England. Mm-hmm. And you get biscuits and gravy in southern Illinois because they came across from Virginia. So it's one of those things where that was the first things. But as soon as there was the National Road, followed by, because most of them originally came by river or the Great Lakes.
Right.
But once the National Road was open, and then, of course, in the mid-1800s, once trains were available, people started just flooding. I mean, you have the covered wagons to a certain extent on the road, but you have once the trains are over, people flooded over literally in the millions, and from both directions. We've all heard the stories of how badly the Chinese were treated in California, so they all came to the Midwest because they were very welcome here. So that's why Chicago has the second oldest Chinatown in the country after San Francisco. And St. Louis has the third oldest. So it's like we have that influence as well. But then you have coming from Europe, and even from the Middle East. I mean, we have everybody coming over. You've got Lebanese, and you've got Dutch, and you've got Scandinavians coming over. And, of course, the Swiss, which is why Wisconsin is so cheese-oriented. In fact,
I've been to some of those places, like New Glarus,
yes.
Wisconsin, which is a little Switzerland.
Absolutely,
it's incredible.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why the very first all-American cheese, brick cheese, was invented in Wisconsin in the 1800s, because that's where the Swiss settled. Scandinavians tended to go north to where it was more like Scandinavia. So you have huge numbers of Finnish and Norwegian and Dutch settlements, although all these groups settled sort of everywhere because you've got Bishop Hill here in Illinois and Andersonville. And so you've got Scandinavians even here in Chicago, sort of northern Illinois. But they tended to go north. Then you had the Germans came in huge numbers. Cornish for the mines. That's one of the reasons why you have pasties mm-hmm. up in Minnesota all the way over to Michigan. You have Belgians, interestingly enough. Belgians were great hoteliers, and one of the hotels that was founded by a Belgian in Chicago was the Dijon Hotel. So if you've ever had shrimp Dijon, that's where that came from.
Oh.
Czechs and Slovaks, they brought European mushrooms and roast pork and dumplings and sour cream. And then you have the Polish, Eastern European Jews, once things heated up, Hungarians, Slovenians, Croatians, just huge numbers, Lebanese Christians, Greeks. I mean, they came in just waves and waves and waves. And basically the entire region was settled and had become, settled within, 50, 60 years. So it just...
Well, in these few minutes, Cynthia, I think you've shown a pretty vibrant ethnic tapestry.
Yes.
Of what the Midwest is. A lot of folks don't necessarily think about that level of diversity.
Yeah.
Throughout the Midwest. And so to just in a few minutes travel around the world in that part of the country is just incredible. And I don't know if I didn't think I heard you mention my people, the Italians.
It was just because there's so many of them.
That's right. We are everywhere, as is our food.
Absolutely.
I want to circle back for a minute on something you mentioned. You mentioned, for example, the Swiss and their cheese influence, and I think some of the Eastern Europeans and some of the things they brought, like mushrooms. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about how these cultures brought different types of foods and introduced them into the Midwest, and then subsequently maybe had to adapt them to the agricultural landscape that exists in the middle of the United States.
Well, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of both aspects. I mean, it's one of the reasons why you've got, a lot of the states have wild rice as the local grain, corn. Those were both very popular amongst people once they got settled here. I mean, people had never had, well, technically maize. Corn simply means the dominant cereal grain of a region, and corn is the corn. Maize is the corn of the Midwest. And so a lot of people had to get used to that, had to learn how to grow it, had to learn how to deal with it. Even if you just fed it to your animals, it was still absolutely necessary. So it's one of the reasons why a lot of the Midwest is known as the Corn Belt, is because corn was so important. Buffalo became huge. So a lot of, and the fish, I mean, if your fish boil in New England was going well, it was going well with Lake Superior whitefish, not with anything from the ocean. So,
right.
So they brought a lot of their traditions, but they also then adopted a lot of the foods, but they also brought a lot with them. And they, for instance, one of the things I think is fascinating is the degree to which rye bread is regional. When I was out on the West uh-huh. Coast, the bread lab folks were saying, oh, we don't have rye bread out here. It's just really hard to come by. You have to order away for rye flour. And, in Chicago, we have whole aisles of grocery stores that are just rye bread because of
right.
the, because you've got so many Eastern European countries. Some regions are sort of specifically, like if you're in Holland, Michigan, you'll probably be eating Dutch food. But you get up into Minnesota, into the Iron Range area, and more than two dozen different countries settled in the Iron Range, in the mines up there. So it's, and the other thing that they kind of adapted to happily, is the stunning abundance. A lot of people moved here because of war and persecution and things like that. But a lot of people also came because they just didn't have any food back home. In Ireland,
right.
the Irish potato famine, I mean, people might think, oh, well, so eat something besides potatoes. Well, for the Irish, there was nothing else. The average diet was like 5 pounds of potatoes a day, maybe if you were lucky, a glass of milk. So when there was no potatoes, that meant no food at all. You get to the Midwest, and you've just got staggering amounts of food. And so all of a sudden, people are eating, 3 pounds of meat a day. because it's available. So it's they brought all of their ideas. One of the things that helped, though, is, of course, is the pork culture of the whole world. All of basically Europe and Asia has a pork culture. So the fact that there were so many pigs in the Midwest from early on, all introduced, of course, but there were so many of them because they multiply so fast. Everybody brought their pig ideas. So like the Germans and the Irish got along really well because both of them knew what to do with pork and cabbage and potatoes. So it's one of those things where it adapted agriculturally, but it also adapted to having neighbors that had similar ideas. And so things started to sort of blend. I mean, there are obvious things that it's like, okay, if you're eating a pasty in Michigan, that's Cornish. That's not so blended as the other things. Or
very different from Nebraska, right?
Yes, exactly, where you've got the Runza. And if you're in Indiana or Iowa, you're going to be eating a pork tenderloin sandwich, which is basically just a great big German schnitzel. So everybody brought something with them, and they all brought great stuff, and it's one of the reasons we're so blended. Of course, we've got, you know, bagels, and we've got sour cream, and we've got stews, and we've got, you know, so it's just, and then, of course, roasts. I mean, it's like you get things on blades, whether it's shashlik or shish kebab or en brochette. It's, and then, you know, and then, like I said, the Lebanese were coming over in the early 1800s, too. So we got a lot of things, you know, from sort of that Middle Eastern flavoring, too. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Everybody brought what they had. And the Greeks ended up owning most of the restaurants. And that's another thing. It's like Cincinnati chili. I mean, that's basically just Greek spaghetti sauce. But they called it chili because it's America. So it's one of those things
as an Ohioan, I definitely have my own feelings about Cincinnati chili, but it is an iconic Midwestern dish. And we are going to be covering so many of these ethnic groups, these cultures, and their food ways and their food histories throughout this entire season.
Absolutely.
And in this series, which I'm so excited to delve deeper into all of these. You mentioned the Greeks. We're going to have someone on the show later in the season talking about how Greeks came over and became confectioners and were leading candy makers when they came to the Midwest.
Certainly.
So it's really interesting. You've given us a really great snapshot of why the Midwest is so diverse. And why the Midwest, you know, what you've described to me and to our listeners is not just a Midwestern story, but the American story.
It is.
A place where people came to settle for opportunity, for abundance, for salvation, where they were welcomed and where they were able to both preserve their own cultural identities while sharing and integrating with their neighbors.
Absolutely.
So, that's exactly what we're trying to present here. And so this is really incredible. I'm thankful to have you come on the show, Cynthia, and hopefully you'll be able to come back sometime later in the season.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to.
We'll be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Root 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Root 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Root 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Well, our final guest today on the show is Lucy Long, the director of the Center of Food and Culture at Bowling Green State University in my home state of Ohio. She holds a PhD in folklore from the University of Pennsylvania and has done extensive research and writing in the area of Midwestern foodways and is apparently a total rock star because anybody that I've talked to said, you need to talk to Lucy Long. So we are very excited to have you today, Lucy. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoy being called a rock star. So.
Well, I think it's well deserved, Lucy. I want to talk to you today a little bit about your work as a folklorist and an expert in this area, because I've often thought that Midwestern food is more of a state of mind than maybe one type of cuisine. Would you say that's the case? How would you describe Midwestern food? Is it a state of mind?
Well, I think it's possible to say that in some ways. And the reason I'm hesitating is that one of the characteristics of Midwestern food is people don't usually think about it. So when you say it's a state of mind, part of that is that they're not really conscious of having a Midwestern tradition.
Interesting. And why is that?
Well, if you look historically at the Midwest, it's a combination of the natural resources, and every region is a combination of the natural environment and then what humans have done with that environment over time. And if you look at the Midwest, the people who were settling here that were European, settling as Americans, were coming in as pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
And in general, they were not focusing on their heritage or on artistic practices. They were focused on survival. So food tended to be very practical, very functional. People didn't want to be experimenting too much.
Right.
They didn't have enough resources to be experimental. So part of what that resulted in is a very conservative, almost anti-adventurous approach to food. A lot of people would consider the food, therefore, very bland. It is based on basic... not basic American, but the British foundation of American culture, which mm-hmm. did be very bland also, so that the only spice that would be used is generally salt.
Right.
Butter can be a flavoring, maybe a little bit of pepper. So that tends to be considered very bland, very unadventurous. At the same time, the food can be seen as very democratic.
It's, how so?
The food is not, it tends to not be gourmet, mm-hmm. is not based on expensive or difficult to find ingredients. It's the kind of food that it tends to be accessible to everyone. So if you have meat and potatoes, you can add sauces to that. You can add spices. So it tends to be very basic ingredients, and that does ingredients that are accessible to everyone. Frequently, ingredients, that are being mass produced and are part of the industrial food system. So that means that they're national foods also.
Right. Well, how does this jive? I mean, what you're describing is very much what I think people often associate with Midwestern foods, simple, bland, basic. But we also know, and we heard from a previous guest about the variety of different cultures and different immigrant groups that settled across the Midwest from all over the world. And they brought their own food traditions and flavors with them. So how does this basic, more bland foundation of the Midwestern food ways jive with this more maybe lively, robust, diverse palate that comes in from all these different corners of the globe?
Right. The Midwest is extremely diverse. many, many different ethnic groups have settled throughout the Midwest. There's a huge difference between urban and rural in the Midwest. So one of the things we're looking at, every region, you can see patterns for cultural traditions. That doesn't mean that every single person there is participating in those patterns. Mm-hmm. So part of the indication that there is a Midwestern foodways ethos and aesthetic, I like to call it. If you talk to someone who comes from another country and starts a restaurant someplace in the Midwest, particularly in the rural Midwest, they tend to comment, well, Midwesterners don't like this much spice. So we offer a version of this that is not as spicy. You know, or we know that Midwesterners are not that adventurous or they're not as familiar. So that doesn't mean that there is not an incredible amount of diversity, and some wonderful, wonderful food. I've had the best Mexican food I've ever had was in Madison, Wisconsin.
Wow.
I mean, even from within Mexico. So Columbus, Ohio has wonderful Somalian restaurants. So, they're just these incredible finds. Where I live in Northwest Ohio, from here up through the Detroit area, is a huge settlement area for people from the Middle East. And this has been going on for 100 years, and for over 100 years. And the most wonderful and incredible varieties of Middle Eastern cuisines are available here. So to say that the Midwest does have a pattern of bland and basic foods, that doesn't mean that there's not that diversity. And most of the people involved in the diversity are also very aware of the patterns.
Interesting. I think it's so important, and we're going to be exploring this throughout this season on this series about the different immigrant groups and how they individually have influenced Midwestern foodways in their own unique way. But I want to kind of loop back to where you started the conversation about the basic ingredients that make up the concept of some of the Midwestern foods. And I know you wrote a piece on the green bean casserole. This is an American icon, very often a Midwestern icon on the dinner tables across the region. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that essay and think about it in the lens, again, I at least see, the casserole, the hot dish as this this state of mind that is synonymous with Midwestern hospitality and warmth. So I want you to share your views and your writings on that particular dish, the green bean casserole.
Well, green bean casserole was something that came to my attention partly because I did not grow up in the Midwest.
So uh-huh.
I am from the South, and then actually grew up in Far East and Southeast Asia. So I have Southern cooking is my tradition. So when I moved to Ohio, this was 33 years ago now, when I moved here, I was teaching primarily folklore classes and American studies classes, and I'd ask the students for their Thanksgiving dinner menus because I was noticing that there were differences between regions. This was before food was kind of a hot topic to study. So I asked them what their menus were, and they would say, well, it's just all the usual stuff, turkey, potatoes, green bean casserole, I'll say, what? Green bean casseroles, that's not one of the standards. And they would all be very surprised. Oh, yeah, we always have it. We have it for family dinners. We have them have it for potluck. And then when I would talk to people at conferences or just friends and family who did not live in the Midwest, and I would mention that this was the Thanksgiving dinner, their responses were sometimes shock, amazement, disgust, disbelief. And I started hearing comments like, well, what would you expect from Midwesterners?
Ouch.
Right, exactly. So, and my three children were born in the Midwest, so I felt like I had to protect, I had to defend them. And one of the tenets of folklore, also of folklore scholarship, is that there is a logic to every cultural tradition, so that people are doing things, even if they don't realize it, they're doing things that make sense to their history, their value system, their circumstances. Mm-hmm. So when you look at something like green bean casserole, initially people would say, well, Midwesterners have no taste. And, you know, that might be true of some of them, but that's true of people everywhere. So, but as a folklorist, I was interested in finding out, well, what is the logic behind this tradition? Why would people embrace this food that the recipe was invented in a commercial in Campbell's,
right,
Campbell's in New Jersey, 1955.
and it still lives on the back of packages of, you know, industrial food that you can buy at the grocery store. For those that may not be familiar with green bean casserole, before you get into sort of the folklore aspect of it, describe it so the listeners can visualize what a green bean casserole looks like.
Okay. The basic recipe for green bean casserole is green beans. These can be canned green beans, frozen. They can be fresh, but that's not that common. A can of Campbell's mushroom soup. Okay, so the soup is mixed in with the beans, and there are these little fried onions, usually either the Durkee company or French's company. You know, that people describe them as similar to potato chips, but a little bit more like styrofoam than potato chips. So you mix all that together. You put in a little bit of milk, a little bit of salt. Actually, one of the interesting things about the original recipe, there was a tablespoonful of soy sauce. And
that's right.
So, and now this was in the 1950s. Now, soy sauce, we tend to think of it now, it's always Asian. But using a sauce from soybeans was actually something that was promoted by Benjamin Franklin. But what I think is very interesting about that is one of the large factories for processing green beans and tomatoes, and all the ingredients for Campbell's soup, is in Napoleon, Ohio. And they actually, the factory has a giant replica of a tomato soup can, a Campbell's soup can. And so very close to that, however, there was another factory. And this was a factory for the La Choy Company, which was the first commercial company to create Chinese, sort of Chinese-American food. They were producing soy sauce. That actually started in Detroit. I have talked to people from Campbell's Soup, and they haven't been able to tell me if there's a connection there. But it's possible, because these factories were only about 10 or 15 minutes apart from each other. Okay, so So this casserole, it's all mixed together. The fried onions are sprinkled on top and mixed in, and it's baked, and that's all there is to it. So partly the simplicity shocked me. As a Southerner, to make something for a holiday, it has to be complicated. You have to have lots of special ingredients, you know, but it also surprised me that it was using all these mass-produced products. It was embracing the industrialized food system. Now, the Midwest is obviously a place where the industrialized food system is extremely large. Agriculture here is very tied in to the food industry. However, so many families and farmers that I talked to said that they all had their own gardens. They would raise a lot of their own food. You know, so I was trying to figure out, how does this raising their own food, they're kind of a pioneer mentality of self-sufficiency. You know, so they can their own food, they'd raise, you know, raise chickens and cows and all, so that they didn't have to depend on the industrial food system, but economically they were tied into it because their occupation as farmers tended to be tied into the food industry. Okay, so there are these contradictions that I was trying to understand. So what I started seeing was people embraced green bean casserole. Initially, it was seen as, this was very modern. You know, this was a sign of being a good, modern, progressive American in the 1950s and 60s, because you were taking something that was new and that was using all this new technology. Okay, you know, now we look at it as, oh, yeah, this is kind of backwards. But when it was first introduced, this was very exciting for people. Okay, so that's part of how it started getting established in the area. And then other aspects of the culture kicked in. The idea that this was something that people liked, and it was very easy and quick and inexpensive to make. This meant that people could always depend on this being eaten and consumed. They didn't waste money. Okay, it was very, very pragmatic. But also, there's the concept of social capital. People knew that other people liked this, that everyone knew what this was. Okay, so if they took it to a potluck, there weren't any surprises. There weren't any unpleasant surprises for people. And so by bringing this to a potluck, people were saying, here, this is something I know you will like.
Right.
And this is all about being together in unity. Okay, now, as someone who lived on the East Coast before moving out here, I always found potlucks to be where exciting new dishes were being offered. So it was a very different kind of ethos and aesthetic. And I didn't realize that until one of my friends after a potluck said, Lucy, why do you always have to bring all this weird stuff? It's like enough. And so she thought I was showing off, or she said, well, it kind of makes the rest of us look bad because we just have this plain stuff. I had no idea. You know, so I started realizing that idea of presenting food that you know everyone likes, everyone is familiar with, it doesn't have any surprises. That's a very important strategy for creating a sense of community, for creating connections that people feel with each other and with the past. So the other thing I started realizing with green bean casserole, when I would ask people how they made it, people would always laugh. Well, you know, it says you have to do it like this on the
box or the can.
Right. So, and a lot of supermarkets out here actually do have displays for green bean casserole right around Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So I'd ask them, and a lot of people would say, well, I stick to the authentic recipe. And then other people say, well, you know, I like to put some raw onions in with it, or I like to add mushrooms or canned chicken. So I started finding people were creating variations with it that could then express their own personality or their own circumstances. So here was a mass-produced industrial product, you know, that people felt this brings everyone together. This is just regular old American food. However, they could express their individuality through this.
Mm.
So, and I think that's a real key. I started finding, even if people insisted that they used the traditional, and everyone thinks it's traditional. So even if they use the authentic traditional recipe, they would do things like have a special dish that they always served it in, or
right.
they would make a special design with the onions on top.
So making something that is so basic and what some may see as everyday becomes celebrated when it's provided in a context that is appropriated by, you know, individual circumstances, whether it's that the holiday or, you know, the potluck dinner, how it's presented, all of these things play into telling that story and telling that Midwestern story, it sounds to me, one where we focus so heavily on community, on inclusion, but then, as you indicated, also celebrating and finding ways for individuality.
Yes. That, I think, is extremely important, especially for Americans, because Americans all want to feel like they are individuals. So at the same time, we need to feel as humans that we are a part of something larger. We are a part of the community, of the collective. So the idea that everybody is sitting down and eating the same foods, you know, and with green bean casserole, it can literally be everyone's using the same products, the same Campbell soup. You know, so when you're doing that, that's celebrating community, yet you can also express your individuality. So in many ways, this is very, very democratic. And it also is kind of an expressing one of the ideals of the nation, that we can all be individuals, but also belong to the nation, to the collective.
Absolutely. That's a great place to leave our conversation, because that's really why I think we're all so fascinated by food. We all need to eat. We all love to eat, but it has this tremendous significance to each and every one of us, and tells that story of our nation and, in this case, of our region. So Lucy Long, Bowling Green State University, thank you so very much for sharing your insights. You are really a rock star.
Thank you.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.